So my name is Olivier Dienz. I'm the Deputy Provost for Student Life and Learning here at McGill University. Before I introduce our honored guest, I'd like to say thank you to Paul Yakin and his team at iPlay. This is a very interesting and fascinating conference. We need these type of conferences. And thank you to all of you for being here and brainstorming with us. We're at the right moment to move forward. And as Chad was saying, our students need this, and our programs need this, and society also needs this. So it is my honor to introduce to you Chad Gadfield, who's one of Canada's foremost historians. He recently stepped down after 8 years as the president of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. And he returned to the University of Ottawa, lucky them, where he is professor of history, and he's also the university research chair on digital scholarship. Dr. Gadfield's teaching and research focus on the great transformation of the 19th and 20th centuries, with special attention to the interrelationship of demographic, economic, cultural, and social changes. Over the year, Dr. Gadfield has won many awards for his scholarship and innovation related to computer-based interdisciplinary, multi-institutional, and international collaborations. The University of Ottawa named him Researcher of the Year in 1985 and also Professor of the Year in 2002, making him only the second person to have had such an honor at the University of Ottawa. Dr. Gadfield was also presented with both the Queen Elizabeth Golden Jubilee Medal and the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Medal in 2003 and 2012. During the past decade, Dr. Gadfield, as you all know, was awarded the J.B. Tyrrell Historical Medal by the Royal Society of Canada, the Prix de la Francophonie by the Province of Ontario, and the Antonio Zaboli Prize by the International Alliance of Digital Humanity Organization. That was in 2011. In 2007, the Canadian Association of University Teachers presented him with its Distinguished Academic Award in recognition of excellence in teaching, research, and service to the community. But as you all know, as president of SHRC from 2006 to 14, I guess. Yes, Dr. Gadfield helped define. This is extremely important for all of us. A new model of innovation that places knowledge and understanding of human thought and behavior in the past and the present at the center of our efforts to make a better future. In this people-centered model of innovation that embraces the possibility of the digital age, graduates from the humanities and social science make key contributions and collaborate across the private, public, and nonprofit sectors. And Dr. Gadfield holds a PhD from the University of Toronto and, of course, an MA and a BA from McGill University. So, Dr. Gadfield.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here, and thanks, Paul, to everyone at the team. Today has made me thought of one thing in particular, being back here on campus. I took a master's seminar with a world-famous medievalist, Charles Bailey. People remember Charles Bailey? I see some nods. Great scholar. And two things I actually remember about this. The first one was in this seminar, September to April, and we could embark on a good research project. I ended up studying town and gown relations in medieval universities. So when I think back on that, I think, kind of interesting. The other one was, it was a three-hour seminar, and Professor Bailey, there were three of us in this class, Professor Bailey would come in, and he had legal-size yellow paper lined, handwritten, and he would read to us for an hour and a half. Then we would take a 15-minute break, and we'd come back, and he'd read for an hour and 15 minutes. Anyway, it is great to be back. What I thought I'd try to do is I had a great experience. We had John Hellman, Professor Weinroth, great profs, great memories, and wonderful. And Charles Bailey, really good guy. Anyway, what I thought I'd do as my contribution is try to situate and contextualize even more. And Federica and Barbara did a great job, and our students this morning, everyone did such a a wonderful job, but I want to go a little further and maybe highlight some aspects of what's going on right now in ways that try to bring together certainly my experience at SHRC, but more, I think, in terms of my ongoing interest in basically the what we're all doing here. And as an historian, I've certainly had occasion, and certainly when I was on the Hill in Ottawa and elsewhere, the occasion to answer the question, you're an historian. What do you do? And I, like many of you, remember, you know, that phone call back in the day, explaining, you know, to my parents I was going to major in history. You know, there was a pause. They were really good about it, but I remember that pause. So I'm going to try to focus on that a bit and try to enrich this discussion. You may know that I've become enamored with the fire hose approach. So we're going to go through a lot of material very, very quickly. All of it I can share with you. There are going to be two or three slides that some of you certainly will have seen before. I hope that my favorites, I just can't stop showing it every occasion. But it's all be, and please, don't, can't get it all quickly, but use that as a basis at least for perhaps some discussion at the end. And I want to say how much I appreciate your engagement and thinking through this topic. Obviously, I mean, I really like the notion and that name. I remember, and this was created, and I like the byline, this notion of a public life of arts and ideas, and the notion of being a leader in innovative, interdisciplinary research and teaching in the humanities that reorients the university toward the world. And I want to pick up on that at various points you'll see today, and I just love that tagline. This event, I think, is also really, really interesting, and I love the website and how it's been updated and submissions and so on, and we'll get to talk a bit more about that. But I want to start by posing a question and say, well, why has this succeeded? And I'm going to situate that because I don't think we should take that for granted. And I think we're going to pause a bit on that. And it's focused on new issues. So let's clarify that right now, not so much. And those of you who were back with the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies in the early 90s, when I had a tour at our graduate school, as we called it then, know that we were fixated on questions around time to completion. We were fixated on retention within graduate programs and so on. And this was across the Canadian scene. It was international as well. The American Association, Council of Graduate Studies in the States, was fixated on this. And I think it's really important. A lot of publications and so on. And this significant study. This one is a book out fairly recently that kind of goes through this effort, and it's the story of the Carnegie Foundation investing, as it says here, and starting in 1991, $85 million to study this effort, and examine doctoral programs across the board, and this is the punchline. They reveal that completion and attrition rates depend upon financial support, the quality of advising, clarity of program requirements, and each department's expectations regarding the dissertation. This is the 1990s. So my question is, at least for 20 years, I think all of us are with the program in terms of the idea that this really helps. So the question arises. We're all here today, and we're all interested in this. Let's go back. So I'm going to take it the other way. I think this could have fallen flat. One reason, and I think it's really interesting, in the 1990s, this dossier was owned by people in dean's offices. Canadian Association of Graduate Studies was really focused on this, and the conversation was among the world of deans, vice deans, and around. There were some other concerns and so on, but it was owned by that. This is, who is this guy, Paul Yakin? I mean, he doesn't know grad, he's not, is he the dean at grad studies at McGill? Like, and who are these people? who are these people? I mean, and I would say, I think there's a lot of you know, grad deans could say, hey, listen, we've been on this case for 20 years. Like, now you're going to get Shirk support and start to have a big conversation. You could also say discrediting of claims. Look, folks, we've been down the road about time to completion, and frankly, there's good reasons for it. It's, you know, we understand life happens. Program diversity. Hey, we've diversified programs. Programs are very diverse. We've heard that lots today. Hey, you know, like, what are you telling us? PhD is doing relatively okay, and we'll talk more about that. That, you know, like, and we could go on. So, you know, what is this? You could also reject old premises. Say, well, sure, let's say there are problems, but let's be frank about that. The answers are pretty straightforward. We need more money. Or we're just not understood. People, they just don't get it. We're going to have to do much better in terms of branding ourselves and telling the world actually how wonderful this is. We're misunderstood. Okay. Oh, you could say, oh, yes, or tweaks are underway. Sure, we're doing some stuff. At our university, we're doing ABC. You're doing that. So we're getting there. We're getting no panic here. No panic here. Or profs could say, hey, listen, and we'll go back, and the good reason for this, we could say, listen, you know, sure, this guy McGill, he's got big ideas. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. I am trying to survive here. I'm doing enough. Thank you very much. So let's think. Turn the other way around. Why has it succeeded? I think, and I think Paul and the group really need a shout out about this, a real engagement strategy. They have really reached out. And I think the white paper was a great strategy in terms of focusing the discussion and get us going. And I think that's been really, really huge. Second, the other thing is really important. It's an outward-in focus. It's really starting out there and looking at us. That's the starting point. It's an outward-in focus. That's very unlike the 1990s. The 1990s, we were still very much in the push mentality. A lot of smart people on campus, and we're going to push it out there somehow. And I think a lot of our preoccupation, it was in the club. In the club. This is really different. In the 1990s, and it was interesting, there was a horrible job market and so on. There was some on this, and I don't want to exaggerate, and I'll show you that. But the focus now is what happens after. What happens after? And then we've heard today posing the question, to what end? From the point of view outside the campus. And I think that's really, really interesting. This is not totally new, 1990s. There was some attention to this, but it was marginal. It was marginal in terms of the real preoccupation, which was time to completion and dropout, retention. Those were the two things that really drove that. So this says, and this is really interesting how this was formulated. Task here, and here we are, to rethink graduate education and humanities, develop new ideas, to begin to change the culture of the academy itself. You didn't hear that in the 1990s. The whole culture aspect was really not a focus of attention, and you heard that today a number of times, and I know on my table we heard that, and I think it's really, really interesting. And the way the degrees are viewed outside the academy, which is really, and paying attention, taking that seriously. And this is Simona, who's here. Where's Simona? Anyway, she was here today, and she certainly picked on that up and got to the fact that from that point of view, it's a revolution, seeds of revolution, which is really interesting, a big change in terms of what's going on. So third reason is focus on the culture of the academy. It's not just about the rules and regulations and so on. It's the culture, and that's really important. Fourth, and I think I'm going to emphasize this, it's now part of a campus-wide, society-driven debate about the character and role of universities. This was not true in the 1990s. And even when I started at Shirk in 2006, we did some polling, and we asked people about universities. And it seems like pretty recent, 2006. At that time, people still viewed universities very, very positively, and there wasn't a lot of ambiguity about what they were in terms of character and so on. And wow, quickly that changed. And nowadays, everywhere we look, The Royal Society collects all over the place, and it's all different levels, which is really, really interesting. And big money. Mellon Foundation, for example, a big grant looking at the undergraduate experience in the humanities. This is recent, and they should be reporting, I think, fairly soon now. Money now, serious money, $1.1 million to look at new careers for humanities PhDs. So this is part of, I think, a big focus. Back to this, I think Jennifer here? She was here earlier at one point today. I think the whole focus now on this notion of program-specific skills, the employable you, this post-campus kind of thinking, and this new other phrase that Paul has been really introducing and pushing a lot, and you heard it today from our colleagues at Western and elsewhere, this notion of public skills, and what does that mean? Very different. Just a month or two ago now, the Canadian Council of Academies came out with this report, and it brings together a number of things. And I want to spend a little time, because I think there still is some confusion about all this. The expert panel is on STEM skills for the future, but in doing that, they look at what they call non-STEM, and I think that's kind of interesting. But first thing, and again, I think the critics would say, hey, you know, things are fine. Let's stop all the stuff. Because this says the whole notion of the skills mismatch, well, it turns out in terms of non-STEM, the top left-hand corner, it's pretty similar to STEM in terms of salary, initial salaries, non-STEM, you know, actually just in the same ballpark. Unemployment down in the bottom right, pretty similar and so on. And we know this from all sorts of studies. There are different levels. Sometimes our grads have a bit more a lag in terms of getting into the labor market and so on, but basically, and there's been a lot of data on that to show all that. But there are some interesting little patterns here. So this is just 2000 to 2011, and you do see something interesting. You can see what happens here in terms of doctoral students increasingly going to the STEM group, as it's called here, and starting to flatten a bit on non-STEM. That happens around 2006-07, which is interesting, and we'll talk a little more about that. Masters, on the other hand, have, and the non-STEM is a light blue, are doing very well. And this is interesting because some of you may remember in the 1990s, there was a whole debate in Canada about whether or not the masters had a future. And there was lots of concern, possibility to go more the U.S. way, where the masters would become. And one of the really interesting things that nobody really anticipated was the growth of master's programs, the multiplication of them in all kinds of new fields and really becoming a very, very important aspect of our work. So I want to go back even further. It was great to see mention of the Massey-Levesque Commission this morning. And I think we want to situate this because there are a couple of things I want to... So this is going to take us from 1960 all to up 2003. And the bottom one is doctoral, red, and overall growth. And this is all Canada. And my point is, in Canada, we've seen remarkable growth at the undergraduate level. Doctoral level, not so much. And internationally speaking, we're becoming a bit of an outlier, actually, on this. So it's kind of interesting. So debates about we have too many, blah, blah, blah. Internationally speaking, I kind of keep that in mind, and you see that the growth of masters and continued uptick there. But upon the bottom there, doctoral programs in Canada, and yes, they've grown and doubled, I guess, in the last 10 years and so on, but still modest. Internationally speaking, modest. The other little thing is interesting, and this is from looking at Shirk in terms of where you get your degree, and somehow the red and blue got switched in this. But anyway, the basic idea is the blue is Canadian, so getting degrees in Canada really starts to go up through the 60s, as everybody knows, and then it becomes, and it starts to level off such that Canadian institutions now are producing about two-thirds, roughly speaking, of profs on campuses, roughly, or of all PhDs being produced that are held in Canada, certainly to show up. So, and that's a really interesting phenomenon. So back to that little growth in terms of doctoral we saw there, that is starting to impact. Because as you know, up until through the 1960s, most profs got their training outside Canada, and Canada only became a key player in this since that time. Here's another graph I want to just dwell on a bit, and this is on the left, full-time faculty from 1960 to 2002, and at the top there is just the growth in the population, just to kind of run these together to see what's happening there. And what you see is that in terms of that, they really go together. But you see in the early 90s, which is interesting, and this is the time when time to completion and all in graduate studies became a real issue, really starts to go down. Now, there's a blip that goes up there in 2002, and that's the thing that I find interesting, and it has a big impact on debate now that in 2008, as early as 2008, I was able to say that half of all profs on Canadian campuses had been hired since 2000. Now, and that hiring just stops, as you can imagine, around 2008. Boom. It's just astonishing how that starts to go the other way. But there's been a huge renewal. So, in terms of cohort analysis, and we'll get back to this a little bit, there is that window there, and I know that this has been picked up a lot, and this is within recent memory, a lot of doctoral students got hired. There was a huge renewal for a short, intense time, and as we know on campuses now, that has happened, and I think it's really, really interesting. The other sort of issue, though, is you see that's an overall decline there starting, and that's where you start to get the emergence, which we know so well, of part-time faculty. So by the time when I left for Shirk in 2006, in our history department, about 30% of our undergraduate courses were taught by part-time faculty. When I came back in 2014, last September, we were well over half. So in that time period, that big change happened, and that's kind of interesting. The other piece of this puzzle, though, and this is overall data, and you could run this all kinds of different ways. This was published in an American journal, and that basically shows that back to the early 80s, and you could go back, that and it's gotten, you know, such that the actual number of faculty positions available has pretty consistently lagged behind the actual production of PhDs. The numbers seem to suggest it's around 1 to 7, and this is smoothing out those kind of bursts that we all know, those years when, in fact, the market was pretty robust. But basically, it leads to what Ian Milligan picked up and wrote a bit about in a Canadian Historical Association talking about this, and he comes to the conclusion that when you look at it, things have always been bad. That, you know, the notion that I think you got to be careful, because a lot of the debate today is related to, and people have memories of, those years before 2008. Basically, from 2000, depending on, it was a lot of hiring, a lot of hiring. And I think that really colors a lot of our thinking. So, and I want to emphasize this one, because I think at the end of the day, we're all here. And this is Paul's initiative and others and Lee and everybody has really succeeded because of something. And I don't think this is, Federica, is he here? It was really good. You and Barbara really started to go down this path. I want to beat this over the head, because I think it's something we don't appreciate. Increasing interest and expectations from across campus. I'm going to detail that a little bit. People looking to the humanities from across campus and the larger society. Looking to humanities. And I want to run with this a little bit. Okay, so here's my first church slide that I just got to show you because I love it so much. And it had such a, I think, a big impact in terms of crystallizing a number. Okay, on a scale ranging from extremely interdisciplinary to exclusively disciplinary, how would you characterize your research? And I know a number of you have seen this, but just for fun, so we're going to have four groups. Think in terms of percentages here, four options here, ranging from exclusively disciplinary to extremely interdisciplinary. And just for fun, we're going to divide it. We're going to have social science and humanities. We're going to divide social sciences from humanities. We never did this at Shirk, and I'll get back to this, but just for fun. And we're going to separate history just because. So you got your four poles in mind. Everybody good? And I know some people have seen this before. So, and I've shown this a lot. No one yet, and this is very robust. Okay, so what this is, all of you were sent an email by a firm related to the Blue Ribbon panel we did on peer review, and over 6,000 of you happily responded, a hugely representative sample. We analyzed it every which way because we have 22,000 email addresses. We can ask you questions when we need to. And So, for the purposes of this, we became real satisfied. This is interesting. This is my favorite question. So what is this showing me? It's showing me a few different things. One is, first of all, it has just become uncool to say you're exclusively disciplinary. And this is like confidential. This is you. It's anonymous. It has nothing to do with anything. People do not want to think about themselves that way. And you go up. Extremely interdisciplinary. It's interesting. So people say, well, what does that mean? And so on. And we've been unpacking that in a whole variety of different ways. But it kind of was really, really interesting. Two, what I find really interesting is the social science humanities didn't really play out in terms of, you did the ANOVA stuff. You couldn't tell them apart very much. And there were some disciplines that are a little different. There's no doubt philosophers, Fedetti, Bob. They were a little more on this side, but nobody really deviated in a major way, which I found really, really interesting. So that got me thinking, and this is one of the points I want to make, is that, one, do we really know ourselves? Do we really know what's happened in terms of the way in which we think about scholarship, the way in which we think about ourselves and so on? And two, is this changing way in which we think about things, is that being reflected in our programs, in our offerings? And this really got me thinking. And so then I've been thinking about, some of the stereotypes in terms of the solitary scholar. And I began thinking about that and the extent to which we are in love, happily, I guess, with footnotes in which we situate our work within this community. And I was thinking about, histories of invisible colleges and ways in which we think and so on. And I think it takes us down a really interesting path. Interdisciplinary has been around for a long, long time, obviously. Do you mean it within the humanities, across social science humanities? What do you mean? And so on. The Canadian Historical Association's got this as their theme at the upcoming Congress at the University of Ottawa. But there's no doubt now. I think it's and how we're thinking about that. What I want to emphasize, though, is what we see, and I've been struck by this, and again, Federica emphasized this, it's across campus to start with, and some of the most unlikely places. And I want to emphasize this. It's interesting, and again, it's reaching out to us. And now we know back to the whole notion of McMaster introducing humanities in terms of the program, every medical school now, we know that. But in terms of research, in terms of therapy and so on, it's really, really interesting. Here we have in the U.S., the National Library of Medicine teaming up with the National Endowment for the Humanities. Or there's a shared horizons, data, biomedicine, and the digital humanities. And the question they were posing, what are the intersections between biomedicine and humanities scholarship? Fascinating. And they could go on and on across campus. So my favorite submission, any of the Munn students here, the authors of this? Yeah? Love it. And I love the fact that you also produced the printed version out there. Terrific. You know, just to get it out there. So, the other thing I want to emphasize is beyond campus, I think that one of the really interesting phenomena is the extent what's motivating, I think, a lot of this interest, and particularly from outside campus. And I would say for the first time historically ever, we are starting to take seriously the challenge of understanding people. And whether it's in business, whether it's you're trying to get elected, whether you're trying to organize your family, no matter what, increasingly, the notion is, you know what? We got to learn more. We got to take seriously people. And I think there's a confidence, a new confidence about that. And I want to emphasize that because I think in the discipline of history, if you look at history books written, I would say until maybe the 1960s, and you look at what evidence were they based on? Minuscule. Let's face it, minuscule. And the great names, Harold Innes, you look at the research that was actually done, what they actually did. It was a great discovery in the 1960s. You know, it was like, whoa, we left out women. Whoops. Ethnocultural minorities. And why? Because, you know, and I won't go through that, but you look across fields. You think about our institutions. You know, when, you know, we built mass schooling institutions from, you know, early 19th century all the way through. Think how recently we asked the question, how do students learn? And we're just starting to figure out that we have to do better. So, you think about businesses. You wanted to be a successful business. And this was through the Mad Men era. All you had to do was get a really, really good ad and convince people to buy your product. No successful business is trying to do that now. They are trying to study you and work backwards. And this is true. Think about that. Medicine. Who are you? Who cares? This is the thing you should take. I'm the expert. Now it's personalized medicine. We're all starting with you. And now there's a whole new emphasis, whether it's personalized shopping, medicine, you name it. It's all about trying to do a better job understanding human beings. What do the humanities do? And I want to focus on this a bit because we've heard a lot, and I think it's true. The humanities historically have taught the capacity to think logically and critically, recognize arguments, fallacies, make coherent, rhetorical, compelling arguments. Okay. I think that's all true. That's good. One, I don't think we have a monopoly on that, and I think every time we beat that over the head, the chemists don't like us so much. And you can go on and on. I think our real calling card is the fact that I think we have an appreciation of human beings, of human thought and behavior, the complexity of that. And I think we understand and we develop expertise in terms of how people think, what they do in various contexts, and how you deal with change. You see, think about all our work, whether it's in literature, history, philosophy, all of it is trying to come to grips with the complexity of human beings. And that is why society, I think, recognizes that. And they want all these other things. There's no doubt about it. And this, you've seen this. 93% of employers care more about critical thinking, communication, problem-solving skills than undergraduates' concentration. You know, that's why we hear so much about competency-based education. We hear so much about that. Why? Because I think now there's a better understanding of the importance of all that. And that's why, you know, in terms of explaining those. Because otherwise, I think if you don't understand that, it becomes hard to explain. It becomes hard to explain the fact that our graduates actually do pretty well. And you've seen all this. I think it's a great infographic and so on. And there have been lots of studies now. This is from American Academy of Arts and Sciences. the humanities and social sciences for a vibrant, competitive, and secure nation. I think they say that's important. So this book it caused a lot of excitement, came out in September and all winter. Some of you have heard that. And basically here, it comes down to the end. History Manifesto is a call in arm to historians and everyone interested in the role of history in contemporary society. And what Joe Goldie and David Armitage are pushing for and saying is that, listen, bringing a historical perspective, an understanding of the importance of context, the importance of complexity in terms of change, in terms of all the things we do in the humanities, that we need that kind of thinking, that way of thinking, that understanding is absolutely urgently wanted by that larger society, and I think it's an unbelievably important opportunity for us. They link that as well, and I want to spend just the last few minutes, and then we can open this up, explaining that or trying to emphasize that. All of these deep conceptual changes are happening, and they explain, in large part, I think, why digital technologies have become so important. The digital technologies are enabling a lot of what I've just been explaining. They've been accelerating, and obviously they've been influencing in all kinds of implications and so on. But in terms of being able to and appreciating complexity, being able and appreciating the way in which human diversity, personal diversity, interacts and meshes with larger commonalities and so on, digital is comfortable. And that's why I think it's interesting in terms of understanding this. It's our fields that are obviously contributing in lots of ways. And you can see this in terms of the extent to which we're all talking about big data now, not because there's more data on particles. It's because the data now is about human thought and behavior. I think that's the key. All the attention in the public about big data would not be there if it were just more data about the non-human world. It would just not be capturing the public imagination, attention, on and on. And I think it's really important. This is really important, and I think it's still out there or not, but this notion that, well, you talk about that, but what are you really talking about? And there's nothing raw data. And I think that book is good in terms of thinking about it as a natural resource, not as a natural resource, but as a cultural one. And one that comes out in a society that's created by human beings and has a context and meaning and so on. That has been some dumb stuff done, and this is kind of a joke in terms of, you know, turning novels plots into data points and so on, and there's been some bad stuff. But there's been some really interesting stuff. I'm really impressed by, I don't know if you noticed a few years ago, one of the leaders in Canada in digital humanities, a literature prof at the University of Toronto in Lancashire, teamed up, and they analyzed Agatha Christie's novels, loaded them all up and analyzed them, and were able to answer a question that had been around for a long time, and that is, when did Agatha Christie start to suffer from dementia? And they were able to analyze this and show. And what was so interesting about that, though, is that it quickly became clear that this had huge therapeutic implications. And now some great new interventions are coming out of this. Who knew? That's why, you know, when people start to say, gee, can I read your email and batch, don't let them go down this path. It all had to do with vocabulary, diversity, sentence structure, on and on. Anyway, so, and the other thing, I think Canada has a real strength here. As you may know, this approach got going early in Canada. This is from 1977, but by that time, by the 60s and 70s, it was a community building across the country in a number of different pockets. And now we can actually begin to think about something that not too long ago seemed to be unimaginable, the notion of a computational turn. And, you know, you think about how deep this goes, and we'll talk about this, the extent to which we've gotten ourselves into a really, really unfortunate place in terms of the way we think about ways of knowing on campus. And again, you know, historically, certainly we can analyze how exactly when that started to emerge in terms of one group that's really good with words, one group that's really good with numbers, and we don't want to keep them, and we want to separate all that, and it becomes very, very hard to think about this. This is a tweet. I was down at an event at McMaster, and it was like, oh my goodness, and you know, that kind of divide that happens around grade 7, you know, and we think that's okay. And I think we've got to rethink that. And again, it's our work that is showing, it seems to me, that, for example, numbers and words are semiotically representations and very similar. And so, you know, why are we thinking about that? You know, we can think about manipulating, dealing with words. Why not numbers? And in fact, a lot of the skills are very similar. And I had a chance to study some of this in the 19th century, looking at school books, for example, and showing how different approaches and how this started to happen. The other thing that is really interesting, and this caused a furor, you might have seen this past winter, in terms of a group of epidemiologists, biologists, making the claim that trying to get a better understanding of human thought and behavior, trying to take advantage of all this, was so important that if humanities scholars didn't get into it, they were going to take it all over. And they were basically saying, look, this is a huge, unbelievable resource in terms of the possibilities. We don't know where this is all going, but let's go. And they called, in a kind of re-enchantment of universities in terms of the one republic of learning and the notion that, in fact, the conversations need to happen across the different ways of knowing. And similarly, you know, in terms of algorithmic thinking, I remember here at McGill, I first kind of got my head around that, and it was in Philosophy 101, my logic course. And so how did this all become something owned by someone else? And I think it's clear it's not, and we've got to start to combine heuristic thinking, algorithmic thinking, and I think a lot of our disciplines, disciplines do this. It goes far. The kind of debates we're having about the dissertation and so on, it's not that. We've got to put that in a big context. It goes much further than that. Because the whole premise of doing a dissertation and so on, and then if you are successful, you have to do the scholarly monograph and so on. This is the Association of Research Libraries in the U.S. Is posing these kind of questions now, and they go far. There's really interesting initiatives that relate to a lot of the things we said here. Early this week, New Ecology of Scholarship, and talking about different kinds of academic production across fields and so on, and remembering, I think, that the journal article or the book, they're means to an end. What's the end? New insights. We're trying to learn about human beings in the past and present. And that's the key, how we do that, and we got to think about that, I think. And we got to get the container content kind of, we got to think about that in fresh ways. We have a lot of history to overcome. You know, I continue this. You know, there was a celebration recently, 50 years after and so on, some years ago now. And my thinking is that we're still tortured by the notion of these solitudes on campus or the fact that on campus we can be distinct from that larger society. And again, it's our research that is showing the extent to which the questions we ask, the methodologies we pursue, are intimately related to what's going on in the larger society. All the research emphasizes those connections. And I think it's really important that we begin to think about that. I used to use this metaphor of thinking about, you know what, we need the depth of what we used to think about as specialization or disciplinary and so on, but we need that. We need to have enough to have meaningful engagement across campus and with a larger society. And I think it's irrespective of what we think we're going to do after. I am unconvinced that the kinds of competencies that you're going to need to get a job in the private sector are any different in terms of this than the ones you're going to need to be a successful academic. My sense is developing different voices to articulate what you're up about, different ways of expressing that, how to engage with others, the notion of co-creation with others. All those skills, it seems to me, are as needed on campus as anywhere else. You need to know how to face it. We need to know how to manage budgets. We need to know how to work in teams. We need to know how to engage. We need to know how to, in my case, help renew our undergraduate curriculum. These are skills we all need, and I think they're going to be valuable on campus. So I don't think we should worry too much about the multiple possible futures and say, oh, if you're going to do this, there's another track. I think these are all that we need no matter what we're going to do, whether we're going to stay on campus or go elsewhere. So I think we've built a structure over quite a while now, and it's really gotten strong during the 19th and 20th century. That's pyramid. And our idea is of increasing specialization. It's based on, again, from our research, a notion of creativity that doesn't hold anymore. And the notion was, you can be creative only after you know every reason why the frontier of knowledge is here. And we know now there's a world of research that says the chances of you being creative go down the more you study, the more you get socialized into why the research frontier is here. We need to think about this in terms of an iterative process, in terms of a going back and forth and so on. And I think, I'm trying to think about what the metaphor, this kind of hourglass shape, where kind of move from, I think we need to start broad. I like the notion of a discipline-based interdisciplinary. I think you have to go deep. I like that. But I think you've got to do it in a way that then goes back out, and you're able to engage across campus. You're able to engage with a larger society, and I think that's got to be part and parcel of the whole experience. So this you know, this metaphor is not going to work well in terms of what's happening now, as we see, is the master's is kind of bifurcated, and you've got ones that go wide and deep and so on. We'll have to think about that. And again, I think that's great. I think there can be a million models. One of the things we heard about today, I think we know, and even in terms of our students, we know that it's been silly to assume that they're all the same coming in, that we can do something to them, and then they're going to all be kind of the same on the way out. Students are different. I mean, and there are a lot of interesting approaches being done now in terms of preparedness, having some initial sense. Okay, I think, you know, we say, oh, students now, we have to get students in, and they have to learn to speak to many different audiences. Well, it could be our student comes in and is very well equipped with that. Given their background and other skills, they may be very comfortable speaking in all sorts of different voices. They may not need workshops or anything else on that. So I think we have to start thinking about this a lot the way every other institution is, in terms of an approach that recognizes that people aren't the same. We've got to get rid of the cookie cutter, and we've got to think about how we're going to get to where we think is significant and important, and how we can help them in ways that I think make sense. I do agree with my colleague at the University of Ottawa. I think it's an extraordinary time. I think we've taken seriously the challenge of understanding human beings in the past and present. I think historians now, I think we're part of our field now is so exciting in terms of, I think, realizing that our attempts to understand change, our attempts to really go further in really significant ways in terms of unpacking the complexity of human diversity, complexity, creativity, and so on. I think that's all really, really key. And my sense, at least, is that that's true across fields. And the good news about it is society wants this. They're thirsting for it. And I think we can engage with them about that across sectors. I think we can engage with other people on campus and so on. And that's why I always end, I love to end with Northrop Frye, because I keep coming back to this. And that, you know, I think we have an unbelievably good opportunity, because when we think about grad studies in the humanities, the timing now for what we're doing is here. I think the readiness is here. It's part of a much larger conversation. I think we can move. I think we can move quickly. I think we know some steps we can take. In my sense, at least, I think we can create the future we want. And I also think we can do so in a way that is true to those medieval universities that I studied with Charles Bailey back in the day. So I'd really like to hear what you think about all this. And thank you very much. I don't know how much time we have. Yes.
Hi, I'm David Lank. I'm a retired professor here at McGill. And I heard recently that one of the courses that had been brought forward while I was still a professor had just been canceled because, and I quote, it's not theoretical enough, and that's in business. With that kind of mentality percolating around the various silos, if society wants it so much, how structurally can a university that is fettered by tenure and other things allow that kind of interdisciplinary growth to really be encouraged?
Well, I think, and thank you very much for that question. And I think my thought is that partly a lot of this has been framed in ways that we got to get over. In other words, pitting disciplinary against interdisciplinary. We still function with so many of these, I would argue, outdated dichotomies. And it quickly gets into that. Whereas I think we can think about that, and that's why I like the expression discipline-based interdisciplinary. I like the notion of, you know, and I would say this is the history of universities, moving forward, keeping the really what deserves to be kept, and then going beyond that. So my sense, at least, is that we can really help by reframing some of the options, reframing some of those possible steps forward in ways that resonate better with the notion that, hey, as I suggested, you know, this is a case in many cases, I think, of a good to great, because there are lots of cases in which people can say, you know, this is working pretty well. And you know, we never want to go out there and say, oh, this is a disaster and so on, because again, and we saw Barbara showed that data. So we don't want to get into a false debate around all that. So it seems to me the sense of urgency and the way forward is on the side of, wow, we could do so much more. Let's be true to the history of universities. Let's renew ourselves. Let's move forward. Such a shy group. Yes. Well, I'm really pleased to be here with. We have colleagues from the University of Ottawa, and thanks to Lynn and Tim and Margaret and Sylvie and others have been stimulating discussions on campus, and I'm sure many of you I know have had those discussions too, and they've invited me in. So I want to say thank you very much for that. It's been great to kind of update myself. So,
Chad, first of all. I just want to mention, while you were doing C.C. Bailey's grad course, I was doing his second year medieval life and institutions course, but that's another discussion.
Seems like yesterday.
I want to ask you, I want to know what's, in some ways I want to ask you what's new here, okay? Because 18 years ago or so, I can remember you saying things like, master's degrees are about disciplining students, and PhDs are really about opening them up to greater possibilities. And in a way, troubling the disciplining and making them interdisciplinary. And as you know, we worked on some stuff that was intended to do some of that. And surely there is a huge issue about technology, but that's not new in education as well. As you well know, in the Historical Atlas of Canada, Volume 2, that you edited, there is a wonderful chart on the spread of blackboards in southern Ontario, which at once shows the esoteric nature of historical research, but also underlined how actually introduction to the blackboard transformed what teaching was and completely changed it. So part of the question becomes, as the new technologies develop, isn't the process really one of re-engaging with the fundamental questions about what we're all about? So is there really anything new in what you're saying?
Thank you, Tim. But I'm flattered that you remember something I said that long ago. Okay, so I think there are a few things. At that time, I think in the 1990s, it was, let's face it, I think a lot of it was coming from the logic of where our scholarship was taking us. That, to me, that was what was going on. I didn't worry, and I thought that a lot of, you know, I was still a little bit in terms of the larger society on the broadcast side. Whereas I think what's changed is that the notion from that larger society that human thought and behavior is not only super important, but we don't really understand it the way we need to, and we need to take it real seriously if we're going to try to do whatever we're doing. So I think so the external is really interesting. And even on campus, in the 1990s, sure, there was some biomedical, but even there, it was on the side of, you know, gee, the doctors should have nicer bedside manner and so on. It was not about, you know, and this is, for example, where the genomics group is coming from. It was not about the complexity of analyzing DNA is not unrelated to the complexities of analyzing text. Let's get some people together and start to think that through. That's a whole new level of consciousness. So I think in terms of the larger campus context and in terms of the larger society societal context. Now, and I think the other thing I would, and I think because the digital is interesting. I mean, let's face it now. There's the number of the larger population that's pretty educated and with access to social media can engage in ways. And I know this has been a really hard row to hoe, for example, in fields like astronomy, where they had to realize that citizen science was not like just some, you know, thing, but there were some people out there that were in this new world able to contribute to their work in unbelievably interesting ways. And you see this, you know, this, and I know there are a number from the museums and so on here. The Smithsonian, you know, being willing to say, wow, we have all these documents, you know, in terms of annotations and so on. How about we all stick them up on the web? We'll have an editorial committee to watch what happens. We'll invite the public to help. And what comes out of that is just unbelievably high quality and astonishing, right? So I think my sense, at least, is that notion of a citizen scholar, for example, who knew? So the decentering of universities in a way that could be terrifying, I would argue amazingly exciting. Let's embrace it. I mean, it's so, the potential of that is so great. It seems to me if we're going to do justice to the complexity of human beings in the past and present, I would say it can't be, you know, like we used to think in the old days, X number of experts on a campus. No, we need, and there's an appetite for that. So I think there are some significantly different things. Sure, I like to think that, and this is, I think, where we were back in the day, I like to think that our own scholarship is taking us there. Our own scholarship. You know, and that's why I think, you know, when we think about how humanities courses are often taught, you know, we get, it's been for years, you know, since I've started teaching just about, I think, we got undergraduates looking at primary sources. We got them, you know, in our literature classes. You were reading authors and you were having to interpret and so on. Now that it's like a whole big deal. Undergraduate research, right? So we knew all along that, you know, it wasn't just about the transmission of knowledge. I mean, I think by the 80s, 90s, we were into the notion that you cannot learn in terms of pouring it into your head. You have to learn by, and that's how you learn. And in our courses, the humanities, I think, are so strong in that. And that's now being recognized increasingly as an amazingly effective and a good way. So, you know, so the whole teaching research dichotomy has started to morph into the notion of a learning community in which, you know, your undergraduates could end up having stunning insights and contribute in ways that who knew. We had a really great day. I got together with two other profs at U of O. We had a digital history day, and it was just for undergrads. One semester, they had unbelievably interesting projects, one related to our Science and Technology Museum, where they had gotten the surveying equipment, the stakes done, and the journals and everything, and they wrote histories and when it was there and what was done and the questions raised about interactions, because the journals would interact in terms of Aboriginal peoples, and they were learning so much through that exercise, gaining expertise in terms of some digital tools and so on. So yeah, I think I'd like to think there's a continuity for sure, but I think the humanities have, our time is now, and our way of thinking about creativity, our whole notion of really fostering, I think it's becoming more and more, I think, recognized that, in fact, there's a legitimate, how to build on that and then go further. So yeah, I think there are some things that are different. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm Juan Luis Suarez, Culturplex Lab at Western University. I would like Chad to push the conversation a little farther in temporal terms.
Okay.
And ask you about the implications of machine learning and the automation of many jobs in the next 10 years, not even further, for the humanities curriculum, education, way of thinking, but also for the skills that we are trying to organize in these masters and PhDs of the next 5-10 years?
It's a great question, because you've all heard the predictions in terms of the extent to which artificial intelligence is back now in really interesting ways. And I think your question is at a really important point in the sense of we've been, I think a little bit viewing those kind of computational power as something that is not part of the expression that I like, a partnership of machines and minds. The notion that, what's driving machine learning is code that's and algorithms and so on that come out of human brains, and that what we increasingly, I think, are looking for is that kind of interaction. And I've only done one piece using in a machine learning framework. We were looking at data from the turn of the century in terms of language patterns, and it was really, really interesting in terms of, and it ended up, it was able to, and what machine learning can do, I think, is help us think through deeply complex data, which is often what we deal with in terms of human beings, help us think that through and clarify and point out in really interesting ways. So I think my sense is that too much of it got down the path of we're going to be replaced, they don't need us anymore. That's going to be true, I think, for a lot of routine work. But I think in terms of our opportunity, in terms of that added value, that partnership, in seeing that as a really amazing advantage, that we have the kinds of skills that can really help use appropriately. Because what's happening now with a lot of it, it seems like a black box. And that's where I think we have to learn the underlying principles of that. We have to learn the decisions being made and so on. And I believe deeply that at least the logic of coding, for example, has to become a part of our curriculum. It's the same way, it's a literacy that should be just part of our normal literacies, and it's related, completely related, to learning any of the modern languages, classical languages, whatever. It has to become part of the mix. Partly to demystify, to be aware of what's going on, but also to be able to enter into a partnership such that you can get help in terms of coming to grips with what are inevitably going to be deeply complex evidence of human thought and behavior. Is there and here?
Yeah, over here.
Hi.
Bryce Traister from the Department of English, also from Western University. I had a I just wanted to ask you about a claim that you made during your terrific talk towards the end, where you said that for the first time ever, we are trying to understand people. And I find the claim to be very provocative. And so I'd just like to ask if you could unpack that a little bit. What is it about today that grants us the temerity to make a claim like that?
I would argue it's the number of, well, I think it's two things. One is the number of people involved in the exercise. So I think historically, we could go back, and at every stage of human society, we can identify some people who are trying to come to grips with that and articulate that at various levels. But I think it was not seen to be a priority for success, however defined, in various kinds, well, I would say across society, various kinds of institutions, political, business, social, whatever, public institutions, it wasn't seen. And I think the history of schooling is a great example of that. How recently we've really focused on how children learn and the way in which we think about that. I think it's pretty recent. And again, in history, you think about, you know, back to my statement, the number of people and the amount of evidence focused on trying to understand historical change. Pretty small. An elite group had to be supported in various ways. Small number. And now, for various reasons, I think we have a concerted effort on campus and beyond, and I think it's become a priority. And I'll go even further, since I'm just here. I'm a simple prof, as they say now. You know, I am convinced that this century will be the century when we do a much better job in terms of building communities, building, and I think you think of the, you know, I know historians hate progress. You know, we hate the word progress. You know, anytime somebody says progress, oh, no. I mean, you know, we're not down that path. But then when I ask historians, I say, when would you really like to live? And so, you know, my sense is that it hasn't helped us to say, you know what, I think what we're doing is super important and it can help us lead better lives. That they're personally meaningful to us, to others. And I think, you know, we're never really going to probe human complexity for sure, but I think we can do better. And I think there's a sense now that we can. I also think, hey, listen, you know, let's face it, power structures on and on, you know, if I were to predict whether this century is going to go well or badly, I'm an historian too. You know, and I'd say, whoa, you know, there are a million ways. But that's why I always go back to Northrop Frye. And whenever I read that, because I think at the end of the day, and I think, face it, in the digital age, I think the decentering and so on, I don't know. Yes. Heather? Or somebody who's ever got the mic. You got to get the mic. That's the thing now. You got to convince someone to give you the mic.
I have the mic. And I'm going to ask you a version, I think, of a question that I posed to you in Edmonton at the end of March, which has to do with how far you take this in terms of administrative structures. I'll ask it a bit differently because we're talking specifically about grad programs here. What should we be giving degrees in? Should we be giving degrees in English, film studies, history, or should we be actually radically rethinking our structures along the interdisciplinary lines that you so compellingly showed us? And the reason that I ask that is that I'm really struck by, I too am really struck by the repetition of these questions. I went to graduate school at a place that got one of those big melon grants in the...
90s?
Let's say it's the 90s. And made no, you know, made basically no headway. But I'm also struck by what you said about we brought in all of these new professors at U of A. It's a little bit earlier, it's 2006, but 2008. All of these new professors into these old structures and now we're having the same debates again. So if there are not two solitudes, and if disciplinarity is deeply uncool, how should we be organizing ourselves within the academy?
Okay, it's a great question, because one of the things, and again, it's really interesting. Whenever I think about questions like that, my reflex is always to go to the research that we produce. So your question is, how do we renew, how do we change successfully? And I would argue there are kind of two parts of that. One is to have a sense of where we'd like to go at a high level, but then to focus on steps forward. I am not on the side of, okay, let's all sit back and demolish all this and we'll start over. I think it may come to that, but I think you first got to identify what are the steps forward that you want to take now, then ask the question, okay, if we took those steps, what would be left of, and then get there. But first, say those steps. And I think that my sense, at least, is that we could say, I think an MA in history, PhD in history, I like that just fine. But I think it's got to be done in the context of what I like to think about as an approach that embraces that openness across campus, that embraces that openness with the larger society, that doesn't have a cookie cutter, that recognizes that students are not all the same, and that has an initial, and I would say, kind of detailed discussion of, okay, what are you bringing to the table? What sorts of, you know, where are you at and so on, and then has flexibility in terms of thinking through, okay, we will focus on this in your case, well, that's okay, and so on, and develops an approach that makes sense in terms of the student, that makes sense in terms of, at the end of the day, we want to know what a PhD in history looks like, for example. And I think, so my sense is an approach that is in tune with our scholarship. I think it's contradictory, it seems to me, to not tell students. Now, maybe the way we all answer those surveys are wrong and so on. The way we think about ourselves is all wrong and it's all misleading, and you can say that. But I think if we look at our work, if we examine our work, we're going to see that we're engaging across a number of fields. You can see that you know, and get what, how we're thinking about our programs, whether it's undergraduate or graduate, in keeping with that. I think a lot of this is our scholarship has gotten way out ahead of, I think, the curriculum we're offering and the way we're thinking about that. I think we should embrace that fact, and I think about it in terms of steps forward. I think you can make meaningful steps forward. The logic of that might lead you to a whole new thing, but I think a focus on steps forward is the way to go.
Well, you just say one last question.
Okay. There's been a very faithful person there. Yes.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. I'm a historian as well. I'm Martha Smith Norris, the Director of Graduate Studies in the Department of History at the University of Saskatchewan. And you talked a lot about the importance of collecting data about human behavior and how we need to engage in a number of fields and do research in terms of the actual tracking of the data. But I'm just wondering, why is it that we don't seem to be doing a really good job of tracking the data and doing the research with regards to the outcomes of the PhDs in the humanities? You know, why are we not, like in departments and in research institutions all across the country, why are we actually not tracking that data and finding out what these graduates are actually doing in once they are employed in different areas?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. First of all, there's no doubt that we're starting to make steps down that path, right? Everyone's go through a program evaluation. You got to madly start trying to find out what happened to your graduates and so on, put together those tables and on and on. But back to your question, it's we didn't, you know, our tradition is to not know much about anything that goes on campus. You know, when you think about it, it's true. Like, you know, who are our students? Analyzing that in interesting kinds of ways. Who's showing up? In terms of how recent it is that there were studies of, for example, the role that libraries play, who takes out books and all that kind of work. So the whole notion of taking seriously what we do. It's interesting, there was mention of Carnegie, and they were talking about this. They launched some years ago a whole program on the scholarship of teaching and learning, invested a lot in it, and it kind of died. And even on campus, let's face it, I personally really like the teaching and learning centers on campus. But I talk to some colleagues and like they're not very useful. And you got to run to them maybe to get a little help, something to get them in, but it's not serious. I mean, I think it wasn't us that said, you know, during the 1970s and 80s, you know what, I don't know what I'm doing up here teaching. I think I got to get, you know, I got to get some instruction and get some help, and maybe somebody should video me and I should figure that out, and maybe, you know. So I think it's a little the Shoemaker, you know, I think it's a version of, we study almost everything, but we don't really worry a lot about ourselves. And I think there's an assumption that happened, I think, with human beings a lot, is that we took for granted, like, I'm a human being, like, I don't have to study human beings. And I know, you know, I spent a lot of time at one point studying fertility decline in the 19th century. I remember trying to explain this to a neighbor. You know, and they were like, you don't know why people have babies? Like, I mean, like taxpayers or like, you know, or wanted to have fewer, like, hello. So it's interesting. I mean, I think we're getting over that notion that we can assume. I think we're starting to realize we got to problematize a lot of that. I think all of us feel we have a pretty good understanding of the students, but now we realize that maybe not so much. I mean, I was knocked out. I remember another slide that I didn't show you, one of my favorites. The Globe and Mail did a survey of undergraduate students and asked them who would be their favorite employer. And in our disciplines, were the most likely, in the two companies that were most identified, our disciplines were the most likely to identify them, and they were Google and Apple. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. So my sense, at least, is I think we're starting to take seriously the challenge of understanding our students and different learning styles. I mean, how recent we started to worry about different learning styles, giving options in class in terms of different ways, you know. So I think, yeah, I totally get, but I think it's part of that larger phenomena of we're now starting to take seriously the challenge that by getting more, as historians would say, evidence of human thought and behavior, that we'll actually be able to learn a lot and thereby maybe enhance our scholarship and how we can contribute.